The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated June 20/June 27, 2022, bordered in red as usual with a narrow inner border in white. Time, the letters in large block print, are superimposed in white upon a background of black and white. Black solid and white lettering. Minneapolis, Knoxville, Jacksonville, Fort Lauderdale, Buffalo, Detroit, Brookshire, Philadelphia, Uvalde. These are the sites of the 213 mass shootings so far this year. Moving on to the brief, there's a photo here of the Capitol, or the dome, and then there are a bunch of people on the ground outside the Capitol. They are gathering in protest. Hearings worth watching. By Eric Cortalesa, the committee investigating the Capitol attack has a primetime plan to captivate the nation. It has been 17 months since a pro-Donald Trump mob attacked the U.S. Capitol to block Congress from certifying Joe Biden's election victory. Since then, scores of prominent Republicans, including Trump, have downplayed the deadly event, referring to it as merely a debate about election integrity or an insurrection hoax. Over six televised hearings in June, the House Select Committee investigating the attack intends to refute those dismissals in dramatic fashion by providing the most comprehensive accounting of that day and the weeks leading up to it. Committee members aim to make an unassailable case that there was an orchestrated conspiracy behind the worst attack on the Capitol since the War of 1812. And by organizing the events with an eye to audience, complete with prime time slots for two of the hearings, they hope to engage even those who feel the country should move on. To my mind, it is absolutely riveting, Jamie Raskin, a Democratic representative for Maryland, tells Time, of the plans for the hearings, which will include both live and taped testimony from members of Trump's inner circle, including at least one of his children. Because it is a story of the greatest political crime ever attempted by an American president against his own government. The assault on January 6, 2021, left several people dead, including four police officers who took their own lives after the attack. Dozens of additional law enforcement officers were injured. Members of Congress from both parties have said they feared for their lives. The event led the House to impeach Trump for a second time during his last days in office. The Senate later acquitted him. Since then, more than 800 people have been charged for storming the Capitol, and nearly 300 have entered guilty pleas. Hours of footage from the riot have become public, fueling multiple documentaries. Nonetheless, the hearings remain highly anticipated, as committee members signaled they have saved the most eye-opening and jaw-dropping information. The proceedings are the culmination of 10 months of work, including the collection of more than 130,000 documents and testimony from more than 1,000 witnesses, all of which gives the panel a chance to advance the public's understanding of January 6. far beyond what was unveiled during the impeachment trial. We've got a lot more material, Pete Aguilar, a Democratic representative for California, tells Time. They had days to collect information. We have had months to gather evidence. Yet questions abound about what the tangible impact might be. Will the Department of Justice follow up with prosecutions of the former president and his confidants? Will the hearings and the committee's subsequent report be regarded as the definitive historical record of what happened? In many ways, the proceedings will test whether the public still cares about that fateful day or whether they're too fatigued by the ongoing saga to unpack it. They will also test whether anything can move most Republicans in Congress beyond their current position, that the assault on the Capitol was simply a protest that got out of hand. The 9-member committee includes just 2 Republicans, Representatives Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois. Both were among just 10 House Republicans who voted for Trump's impeachment. They've both paid a political price. Cheney lost her leadership position in the House GOP and is in the midst of a bruising primary fight. Kinzinger chose to retire. "People must pay attention," Cheney recently told CBS News. "People must watch and they must understand how easily our democratic system can unravel if we do not defend it." Stephanie Murphy, a Democratic representative for Florida, echoed other committee members in insisting the hearings have the potential to change hearts and minds. "Think of it like a Netflix or a documentary miniseries of sorts where, in one compressed period of time, we are telling a fulsome story, pulling together all of those threads that have been coming out drip, drip, drip over the last year," she says. While the committee has not released a full witness list, people close to former Vice President Mike Pence are expected to testify, including advisors Greg Jacob, J. Michael Luttig, and Mark Short. The committee is actually acutely aware that conservative groups and personalities will try to discredit findings that may implicate Trump or his allies. "I expect them to counter-program," says Murphy, "but all of the members also have a platform outside the hearing itself to reinforce what was presented in the hearings and to tell the American people the truth." That is part of why, Aguilar says, committee members are keeping so much of the strategy around the hearings close to the vest. You will have to tune in to see from the brief by Eric Cortaleza. 7 questions for Laura Dern, the Jurassic World Dominion star, on revisiting an iconic character, radical filmmaking, and one real-life hero she would love to play on screen. This is by Shannon Carlin, and it takes the format of question from the Time representative and answer from Dern. Question: what excites you most about returning to play Ellie Sattler in this new Jurassic installment? Answer: in 1993, it was rare to see women in any movie without makeup, not wearing the sexy outfit. Everyone working on Jurassic Park considered diligently how Ellie would dress, her stunts, her iconic feminist lines. It really mattered to us, and it really mattered to Jurassic World Dominion director Colin Trevorrow how she would evolve. My interest in soil science and climate change, interests that Ellie would care so deeply about now, became a big part of her story. Question: what is Dominion trying to say about the climate crisis? Answer: Ellie has turned to soil science because soil can save us all. She's focused on how to protect us from the ills of industrial farming, petrochemicals, genetically modified seed, and the corporate greed around our food table. Question: why do you think so many people have connected with this character? Answer: little girls and boys have come up to me and said, You were the first female character I saw on screen, equal to the men. Recently, a woman I deeply admire, the first female congresswoman in her district, who is a committed supporter of a bipartisan gun bill, told me Ellie Sattler was the reason she went into politics. Question: when you made Jurassic Park, you were an Oscar-nominated indie actor working with the likes of David Lynch. What was it like to then work with Steven Spielberg and all those dinosaurs? Answer: I worshipped Steven Spielberg. Jaws and Close Encounters to this day are two of my favorite movies. Without even knowing what the movie was about, I was already in. It felt as radical and indie as anything else I'd made. It was not yet a franchise or a blockbuster. It was a bunch of people standing around going, how are we going to do that? Question: have you ever talked to David Lynch about Jurassic Park? Answer: Stephen and David have a profound kinship as fellow radicals in the world of cinema. I believe in addition to Hitchcockian, the next two cinema names that are now in our dictionaries are Lynchian and Spielbergian. Question: I love that you consider Spielberg radical on par with David Lynch. Answer: well, that wasn't a question, it was a statement. Answer: David is thought of as such an insane radical, and I remember one day doing a scene in Jurassic Park with Steven, and I was like, you're completely insane, you and David, only you two could do something like this. He was like, are you kidding? That's such a compliment, comparing me to David Lynch. Why is this insane? I said, dude, I'm standing in a basement, terrified. A beast is coming at me. And finally, I feel a man put his arm on my shoulder. I feel so relieved. Sam Jackson has shown up, and it's his dismembered arm. Who else is going to put me in that circumstance? Question: after playing Ellie Sattler again, are there any other characters of yours you would like to revisit? Answer: I would want to play Ruth Stoops from Alexander Payne's 1996 film, Citizen Ruth. Question: that movie, which focuses on one woman's right to choose whether or not to have an abortion, feels even more prescient now. I'm begging any streamer, anybody, please get that movie out there right now. It is the most important movie I could have made for this moment. I think for my kids' generation, teenagers, new voters, to see that movie is really powerful. I'm so proud of that movie, and as a first feature for Payne, it is so radical. From the View inbox, Climate is Everything by Alejandra de la Garza, staff writer, Climate. As hurricane season approached Florida, lawmakers in May raced to address a crucial gap in the state's coastal defenses, property insurance. Insurance costs in the state increased about 25% in the past year, according to the Insurance Information Institute. Rampant litigation and fraud are part of the problem. So is climate change. Rising hurricane losses in recent decades drove most national property insurers out of Florida. They were replaced by small local players, which are more vulnerable to the whims of the reinsurance market. Insurance for insurance companies. Storms also create opportunities for bad actors to take advantage of the system, like contractors looking for roofs to fix that may or may not have been damaged, and then charging insurance companies. When it's storms and fraud, which is what we've had over the last few years, says Charles Nice, associate director of the Center for Risk Management Education and Research at Florida State University, companies cannot survive. Damage from extreme weather events is also jacking up insurance costs in other parts of the U.S., like the Gulf States and California. At the same time, the industry's undermining climate policy, according to Think Tank, Influence Map, and underwriting fossil fuel projects that could increase risks to homes they insure. May 26, Florida approved a $2 billion state-backed reinsurance fund, along with other measures. Those may bring down near-term costs, but they will not change the longer-term pattern of stronger hurricanes and the growing cost of rebuilding. An immediate option is to upgrade buildings, which in theory will limit future damage and reduce insurance payouts. That's where Florida may be heading. One of the new programs gives homeowners up to $10,000 to make improvements like upgrading doors and roofs. We have not figured out a way to stop a hurricane yet, says NICE. That means hardening homes. From the View essay, Society, How I Lost Myself to Motherhood by Katie Gutierrez, who is author of the novel More Than You'll Ever Know. It is impossible to gauge the depth of a hole you're in until you begin to climb out. I have felt this way in the most challenging times of my life, usually when suffering loss. I remember the worst moments in flashes, sobbing in a closet, inhaling a scarf, gin, and curvy roads, lying beside my bulldog, whispering I'm sorry in his ear, moments of despair whose dimensions I did not fully understand until they lifted. I feel this way now, more than 2 years after the U.S. suffered its first surge of COVID-19. Our daughter's now 4, and our son, nearly 2, half her life and all of his living in a pandemic world, and both still too young to be vaccinated. Our family was until recently in the minority. None of us had gotten the virus that's killed more than 1 million Americans. But trying to protect ourselves came at great personal cost. We chose to be parents, but we did not choose to parent in isolation. And I can see now that beneath the weight of pandemic motherhood, I lost myself. Pregnancy and birthing have always had a way of obliterating the self. Many of us emerge with shifted bones, dysfunctional organs, stitches, and scars, all of which can change our relationship with physicality. From 6% to 20% of new mothers suffer from postpartum depression. While up to 1 in 3 feel high anxiety levels, either during pregnancy or in the postpartum period. Sleeplessness clouds our intellectual faculties, blunts our creativity, and whittles our patience. My second pregnancy, like my first, was debilitatingly painful, and I bled for 3 months after having our son. He did not sleep through the night for 15 months, a sentence so banal it cannot possibly convey the despair of being awoken to screams every few hours for more than a year. He's also prone to respiratory infections, so until Omicron cases started falling in our city this March, we mostly stayed home. The reprieve parents might normally get from babysitting or a return to the office simply did not exist for us. There I was, screaming into a pillow at 3 a.m. because the baby was crying again. There I was, smothering frustration that felt too close to rage as my daughter refused to eat dinner but asked for a snack the moment I sat down to work. Meanwhile, new qualities emerged, a deep fear of the world outside our doors, rage at the politicized approach to public health, a well of cynicism in my formerly open heart. All of it left me feeling like a stranger to myself. I yelled, then apologized, sick with shame. What is wrong with me, I often thought. Who am I? I'm a mother. My body was theirs to feed from and climb on, my mind consumed with keeping them safe, healthy, and loved, and consumed with anger at myself every time I failed. I may have been a full-time mother, but without the ability to live into the self I had created apart from motherhood, I was not the one they deserve. Now that our daughter's in school, our son sleeps through the night, and we're venturing out more, I'm slowly carving a path back into my mind and body. As I do, I see flashes of the mom I want to be. But this is not a happy ending, because the past 2 years in which mothers left the workforce in record numbers to handle child care and are now suffering a mental health crisis are a damning preview of what's to come if Roe v. Wade is overturned. People with uteri forced to sacrifice themselves to a role the U.S. deems more important than our autonomy, our ambition, our own actual lives, yet will not support at any point. I live in Texas, which has effectively already banned abortion. And from where I sit, it is easy to see the worst-case scenarios, an increase in America's abominable maternal death rate, women criminalized not just for self-managing abortions, but for miscarriages and stillbirths, cycles of trauma and poverty and abuse continuing unabated. The best-case scenario, what I and so many others have lived through, a complete loss of selfhood. I can't help thinking that is the point. The brief news, here's a photo. It's either dusk or a pale darkness. In the background, it's a smoky looking brown. And there's a blaze of light on a continuum diagonally upward from the ground. It is the HIMARS, HIMARS rocket system in use during multinational exercises in Morocco, June 9, 2021. This is from The World. Biden balances military aid and escalation risk in Ukraine, by W.J. Hennigan. President Joe Biden's decision June 1 to provide Ukraine with advanced rocket systems that can strike targets from dozens of miles away gives Kyiv a new, much-needed advantage in its hard-fought war with Russia. After months of imploring the U.S. to send long-range missiles, President Volodymyr Zelensky and the Ukrainian military will soon have a weapon with roughly twice the range of the current artillery pieces they're using to fight the better-armed Russian troops that have invaded the eastern part of their country. Moscow noticed, speaking with reporters after the announcement, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov accused the U.S. of dangerously escalating the war, not only raising the specter of increased fighting in the nation, but also potentially spreading it beyond Ukraine's borders. The U.S. is deliberately and diligently pouring oil on the fire, Peskov said. In fact, the decision to provide 4 U.S.-made high-mobility artillery rocket systems, HIMARS, was debated for weeks before Biden felt comfortable sending the weapons, administration officials say. Even then, the president wanted multiple assurances from Ukraine, including from Zelensky himself, that HIMARS would be used solely as a defensive weapon and not fired into Russian territory, the officials say. As a safeguard, the rockets that the administration decided to provide have a maximum range of around 48 miles, the officials said, rather than the more advanced HIMARS munitions, some of which can travel up to 300 miles. Such deliberation has become a recurring theme in Washington's engagement in the 3-month-old fight in Ukraine. From the start, Biden has been pushed to send additional shipments of sophisticated American-made arms. Every few weeks, he faces the same dilemma. How far can the U.S. go to provide military aid without escalating to open war between its NATO allies and Russia? Finding the balance is the driving factor behind every aid decision inside the White House and Pentagon since Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered the February 24 invasion, officials say. We are mindful of the escalation risk, Colin Call, Under Secretary of Defense for Policy, told reporters at the Pentagon after the decision to provide the HIMARS systems to Kyiv. But in the first instance, we are focused on what we think the Ukrainians need for the current fight. Around 90% of the world's nuclear warheads belong to Russia and the U.S., and these arsenals loom large as the Biden administration seeks to keep pressure on Putin to stop his military campaign. The White House wants to maintain a posture that can prevent or limit escalation. So long as the United States or our allies are not attacked, we will not be directly engaged in this conflict, either by sending American troops to fight in Ukraine or by attacking Russian forces. We are not encouraging or enabling Ukraine to strike beyond its borders. We do not want to prolong the war just to inflict pain on Russia, Biden wrote in a New York Times op-ed, explaining his decision to send the HIMARS rockets. It remains unclear what repercussions Ukraine faces if it uses HIMARS to strike Russia either accidentally or on purpose. It will take around 3 weeks for the U.S. to train the Ukrainians on the rocket systems, which will double the range of Ukraine's artillery from the current 20 miles with the U.S.-provided M777 howitzers. The additional range will be key in the Donbas, where the war has become an artillery duel, with the two nations exchanging fire each day. But the decisive factor, Washington believes, lies not with any single weapons platform. It is a grinding conflict, Call said. No system is going to turn the war. This is a battle of national will. Another page of seven questions. Now, this is by Billy Perigo, and it says, Borgia or Borga, B-O-R-G-E, Brenda, B-R-E-N-D-E, president of the World Economic Forum. I'm going to proceed by pronouncing this Borga, Brenda. Question. We're speaking before Davos, the theme of which is history at a turning point. Could you describe what kind of turning point that is? Answer. We are probably in the most challenging geopolitical and geoeconomic situation in decades. The challenges we will discuss at Davos are climate change, the war in Ukraine, and making sure the pandemic recovery does not end in a contraction. Global challenges need global solutions, but global solutions are more difficult than ever because of the polarization among the big powers. Question. What role does the WEF see itself playing in resolving those tensions? Answer. Many of the most pressing challenges can benefit from a multi-stakeholder approach. In Davos, we will make sure, for example, on climate change, that we have the big companies of the world committing to going net zero by 2050 through the CEO Climate Alliance. We're also getting the big companies of the world, what we call the First Movers Coalition, to commit to green their supply chains. This is the Apples and the Amazons of the world saying to their suppliers, if you do not reduce your CO2 footprint, we will just not buy from you. Question. Vladimir Putin has addressed the WEF many times. Russian oligarchs, many of whom have now been hit by sanctions, regularly threw lavish parties at Davos. Will any of them be welcome ever again? Answer. We do not have any Russian companies in Davos this year, nor any sanctioned people. We will have a big focus on the totally unacceptable war in Ukraine. When we are in the middle of a war, it's very hard to think about what the situation will be in the future. But with the way we are seeing Russia acting, no. With the current approach, I do not see any kind of political rapprochement in the years to come, that was any kind of potential rapprochement in the years to come, unfortunately. Question, during the pandemic, there's been a surge in global wealth inequality. Is that healthy for the world? Answer, the short answer is no. For the first time in two decades, we're now seeing an increase in the amount of people living in extreme poverty, ending a period of historic poverty eradication. Question, what's the best way to redress that inequality? Answer, for developing countries and emerging economies, the past three decades have definitely been very positive in the sense that they have given them unique opportunities. That economic model is something we will have to try to continue, but the growth has to be more inclusive and sustainable. Inside countries, this is a domestic issue that can and should be addressed with tools such as redistribution and taxes. In my view, rising inequality is challenging the legitimacy of the social market economy. Question, do you see rising polarization as an outcome of this increase in inequality? Answer, inequality is definitely part of the reason, exacerbated by social media. In the beginning, social media was a way for ordinary people to have more say with leaders. But for some state actors and other people with a clear agenda, using social media is a low-cost way of creating conspiracy theories. Question. The theme of Davos last year was the Great Reset, which spawned lots of conspiracy theories. What did you learn from that experience about communicating your message? Answer. It is very unfortunate. I am flabbergasted. The Great Reset was really about using the post-COVID situation as a way of getting it right when it comes to growth, inclusiveness, and climate change. The planet's burning. We cannot stop talking about businesses' responsibility for taking care of the environment. We will not change that message because some people on the fringes are spinning this into something bad, when it is really the right medicine for getting the planet back on track. But we might have to fight back tougher in the future. From society, the GOP strategy to use trans sports bans for political gain. This is by Madeline Carlisle. In spring 2020, Idaho became the first state in the U.S. to ban transgender girls and women from participating in women's sports. 2 years later, 17 states have enacted similar laws. Trans athletes, particularly trans girls, are now in the midst of America's raging culture wars as bills targeting trans and gender-expansive young people proliferate across the country. Sports bans have often served as the first move in a larger assault on trans rights. In 2021, Texas, Florida, and Alabama each enacted a sports ban. This year, Texas has taken steps to deny trans youth access to gender-affirming care. Florida has banned classroom discussion about gender identity and sexual orientation in primary grade levels, and Alabama has done both. Trans people are either full members of society or we are not, says Jillian Brandstetter, a communication strategist at the American Civil Liberties Union. The moment our civil rights start coming with asterisks and exemptions, it leaves the door open for a lot of the very hostile and cruel legislation we've seen introduced this session. The reason for this explosion in sports bans is not a surge of trans student athletes dominating the playing field, political strategists and LGBTQ advocates say. It is politics. Conservative groups and lawmakers realized the issue could excite Republicans and potential swing voters, drawing them into broader cultural debates surrounding trans rights in the U.S., battles that tend to serve Republicans electorally. The idea of trans girls and women competing against cisgender female athletes tends to trigger emotional responses in people who do not know an out trans person, playing on stereotypes about gender and biology. The issue acts as sort of a gateway drug for people into the larger debate around gender and who gets to call themselves a woman, says a conservative who works on Title IX issues, who requested anonymity to speak candidly about the rise in legislation. The bans are gaining steam for the same reason election audits and critical race theory bans have been popular over the past year, says Republican strategist Sarah Longwell, who had been critical of the GOP under Donald Trump. They are PR campaigns masquerading as legislation, designed to keep culture wars at the center of the conversation. A March 2022 YouGov poll found 77% of Republicans oppose allowing trans student athletes to play on sports teams that match their gender identity, compared with 24% of Democrats. Just as same-sex marriage was used as a wedge issue for Republican voters in the 2000s, these are the new wedge culture war issues that help drive GOP enthusiasm and, more importantly, alienate Democrats from swing voters when they fail to provide a coherent counter-narrative, Longwell says. Republicans are on a fence on these issues, and it is working. Democrats still have not figured out an effective defense, let alone an offensive strategy of their own. While GOP lawmakers claim the bans are designed to protect women rather than to discriminate against a vulnerable group, LGBTQ advocates argue they're a solution in search of a problem. There are vanishingly few examples nationwide of trans athletes attempting to compete at all, and those who do are subject to local policies. There is not reliable national data on the issue, but in Michigan, for example, the Michigan High School Athletic Association, MHSAA, reviews whether trans athletes can play on a case-by-case basis, and the MHSAA told the Detroit Free Press it has had an average of 2 requests a year out of 180,000 high school athletes in the state. In that context, expansive state-level bans are both unnecessary and cruel, argues Catherine Oakley, state legislation director and senior counsel at the LGBTQ advocacy group Human Rights Campaign, which has challenged state-level sports bans in court. But if the small number of trans athletes makes statewide bans seem irrational, it also may be what makes them possible. The lack of visibility trans people still have in the U.S. is part of why these laws are getting passed, says Delaware's Sarah McBride, the first openly trans state senator in the country. People perceive the harm that they're committing against trans kids to be narrow, she says. In reality, the effect of these laws on trans youth could be devastating. A January 10 poll by the LGBTQ suicide prevention nonprofit, the Trevor Project, found 85% of trans and non-binary youth said recent debates about anti-trans bills had negatively affected their mental health. The rise of anti-trans legislation can be traced back to June 2015, when the Supreme Court ruled the Constitution protects the right of same-sex couples to marry. With the marriage question seemingly settled, gender identity became the next theater in the battle over LGBTQ rights. The following year, the first wave of anti-trans legislation crashed across the country in the form of bathroom bans, most famously North Carolina's HB2 in 2016 banned trans people from using public restrooms aligned with their gender identity. The backlash was fierce and immediate. companies boycotted the state en masse, raising the specter of $3.76 billion in lost revenue, according to an AP analysis. The law was partially repealed and has since expired. The state's Governor Pat McCrory, a Republican, lost his re-election bid that November. It was viewed as a losing issue and no one wanted to touch it, says Terry Schilling, president of the conservative advocacy group American Principles Project, APP, which has promoted anti-trans rhetoric. That same year, Trump won the presidency, promising to be a friend to the LGBT community. But once he took office, his administration began to roll back protections for trans people, including the Obama administration's policy that Title IX protected trans students' access to a restroom, locker room, or sports team aligned with their gender identity. Then in 2018, two trans girls won Connecticut State High School Championship track titles. News outlets throughout the U.S. ran stories scrutinizing the bodies of the two black trans athletes, pointing to them as the exemplars of the threat to women's sports. Both Connecticut runners were later named in a lawsuit filed by the conservative legal group Alliance Defending Freedom on behalf of four cis female runners, alleging Connecticut's trans-inclusive school sports policy was unfair. The case is pending before the U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals. By 2019, the issue had become a political tinderbox. Schilling had seen conservatives, including Donald Trump Jr., tweeting about trans athletes, and he began urging Republicans to run on the issue. APP says its affiliated super PAC spent about $600,000 that year on ads in the Kentucky governor's race, arguing that Democratic candidate Andy Beshear was a threat to women's sports. APP contracted with the data science firm Evolving Strategies to track the impact of its messaging and estimates 25,000 voters were moved to the GOP by the advertising. Beshear won the race. The following summer, Politico reported that those in the Trump orbit were split over the issue. Some in the then president's camp reportedly felt campaigning against LGBTQ rights would hurt Republicans. While others shared Schilling's perspective, the issue had the power to rally the base. It was a hunch, Schilling says. We knew it was popular with the people, and we thought this could be something that politicians actually talked about. APP says it began spending bigger on the topic, cashing out more than $5 million combined with its Super PAC affiliate on ads in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Georgia that argued Democrats threatened women's sports, among other talking points. By the end of 2020, 20 anti-trans sports bans had been filed in legislative sessions, and compared with North Carolina's bathroom bill from 4 years earlier, these laws were met with a much more muted response from the left and the corporate world. Not a single major company has boycotted a state over such a law, emboldening Republican legislatures to go further. Trans athlete bans have since exploded in state legislatures and begun to dominate national political discourse. By May 2021, Fox News had aired more segments on trans athletes that year than it had in the previous 2 years combined, according to the nonprofit Media Matters. Schilling's APP says it has already raised more than $6 million for an upcoming midterm campaign that will focus on the athlete question. But McBride, the Delaware state senator, thinks the GOP will ultimately lose on the issue, as it has in debates over LGBTQ rights of the past. The more the country understands how the policy impacts trans people, the more they begin to understand and learn about who trans people are, McBride says. The clock will begin ticking on the political effectiveness and possibility for this type of legislation. This article was written by Madeline Carlisle with reporting by Simone Shaw. There is a map here. It shows the states of the U.S. in color, the colors of blue through aqua, through gray, through coral, through red, with gender identity policies being coded at a degree to which current laws, when taken together, protect or restrict the rights of trans and gender expansive people. I will not read to you the colors of each state, but I will give you segments that are pretty well clumped together. The more protective, the bluer states are on the West Coast, including Hawaii. Then moving east, they include Colorado and Minnesota, Illinois, and the New England states even as far south as Maryland up through Maine. Then the red states, and those are the more restrictive gender identity policies, include Montana and Arizona in the west. The Great Plains states, from South Dakota through Texas, with Kansas being coral and North Dakota being gray, which is really in the middle, it's neutral, then most all of the southeast states, excluding Florida and North Carolina, which are coral. And then there are a few other states here and there that are either red or bluish or the in-between colors. The risk report by Ian Bremmer. Colombia's election shows staying power of populism. It is a good time to be a populist, just ask Colombians, who May 29 for the country's presidential elections voted through two political outsiders to the second round for the first time in 20 years. In a nation that's never elected a leftist president, a rarity in Latin America, leftist senator and former M19 guerrilla Gustavo Petro finished first with 40.3% of the vote. Populist former Bucaramanga mayor Rodolfo Hernandez, a septuagenarian, Trump-like construction magnate, who ran as an independent and campaigned mostly on TikTok, came in second with 28.2% of the vote, edging out the centrist former Medellin mayor and elite favorite Federico Gutierrez. Both Petro and Hernandez ran on anti-establishment platforms, promising sweeping change, tapping into the public's yearning for change in a context of widespread dissatisfaction with the status quo on the back of COVID-19 pandemic and worsening socioeconomic conditions. This discontent was on display last year when a failed tax reform proposal triggered massive street protests against the government. Petro and Hernandez will now face off in a runoff June 19, which was like a few days ago. On paper, the ideologically ambiguous Hernandez should have the advantage, since he can appeal to Petro's own base of anti-establishment voters, but also to most conservative and moderate voters who consider the ex-rebel too far left. And because he has just come into national politics, his name recognition is bound to soar. Petro, in contrast, has much more limited room to grow, mainly by moderating his tone to attract the few center-left voters who went for other candidates in the first round. The latest polls have Hernandez narrowly in the lead, but a Petro victory in the vote is within the margin of error, whereas Petro has had a long political career as a member of Congress, mayor of Bogota, and now three-time presidential candidate. Hernandez is an unknown quantity. He's refused to participate in presidential debates and has never been the subject of much public scrutiny, meaning voters have not been exposed to his liabilities, including a corruption investigation, an assault that got him suspended from his mayoral post, and a record of controversial statements. Moreover, in recent days, he's reaped endorsements from the ruling class and the business elites, which could dull his anti-establishment shine. Whoever wins, two things are certain. The next president will represent a significant departure from recent Colombian history and a rebuke of politics as usual. But lacking congressional majorities and bound by high inflation and fiscal constraints, he will struggle to deliver solutions for the problems Colombians will have elected him to fix. Change is easier said than done. Time off television. Review An Old Man on the Run from a Lifetime of Bad Choices by Judy Berman. This show premiered June 16 on FX. Live long enough and circumstances will force you to take stock of the big decisions you have made. Did they turn out how you had expected? What did you sacrifice? Whom did you hurt? And was the pain you inflicted on others or the pain you caused yourself worth it? For the title character of FX's The Old Man, known as Dan Chase, among other aliases, and played by a weathered to perfection Jeff Bridges, that overdue moment of reckoning has finally come. A rogue CIA agent who's been hiding off-grid but in plain sight for decades, he's haunted by nightmare visions of his late wife, and by his paranoid conviction he's suffering from a cognitive decline similar to the one she experienced. It turns out the real threat to his life is external, emerging without warning from his past, to put him back on the run and endanger his connection with his adult daughter. But what makes this adaptation of Thomas Perry's 2017 bestseller more than just another boomer action-adventure epic is its interrogation of the selfish, destructive, and self-righteous Chase's claim to heroism. His survival has come at a high cost to the people around him. One such person is Harold Harper, John Lithgow, a former colleague turned adversary at the agency who has ascended to a top position at the FBI and is called in to lead a manhunt for the fugitive Chase. Lithgow, portraying an erudite company man with an adoring protege, Alia Shawkat, makes the ideal foil for Bridges, whose all but feral Chase can still switch on the rugged charm when necessary. Harold's ambivalence about capturing his old cohort adds pathos to the beautifully shot show's many imaginative action scenes. In cozy homes, as well as in dark, deserted stretches of road, Bridges, who in real life is a 72-year-old lymphoma survivor, believably vanquishes, or at least evades, pursuers half his age. As exciting as The Old Man generally is in the four episodes provided for review, out of seven total, it is also too sloppy to be a great political thriller. There are plot twists that create plot holes, big enough to pilot a C5 through. It takes a frustratingly long time to get a sense, via flashbacks, to his CIA tenure, of who Chase is, what matters to him, and what he did to blow up his life all those years ago. Suspense that does not serve much of a thematic purpose. The show flirts with sexism. In the course of his journey, the widower meets a divorced woman, Amy Brenneman's Zoe, who seems desperate for companionship and cannot stop talking about her ex. Yet as she becomes entangled in Chase's crisis, the character deepens, and what initially comes across as a thoughtless, one-dimensional depiction from creators Jonathan E. Steinberg and Robert Levine gains purpose. Zoe becomes an avatar for everyone Chase has endangered to serve his own aims. During one tense sequence, he envisions how he might escape apprehension by killing her and fleeing the scene. The question that coalesces midway through the season applies to so many stories about the lone action heroes, whom viewers never stop rooting for, even when their crusades leave an enormous body count. Why should one troubled man's continued survival justify so much suffering? It takes on extra urgency in the case of Chase, who has already lived a full life, made some catastrophic choices, and whose motivations may turn out to be more personal than political. Maybe, the old man suggests, there are more important things than survival. Judy Berman wrote the review, and there is a photo here of fugitive Dan Chase fleeing the feds, flanked by his loyal attack dogs, Dave and Carol. They look like Rottweilers, and it's dusk out on some deserted road. It looks like in a desert region. I see sagebrush kinds of plants. The headlights are on his vehicle, and he's standing with his back to the vehicle, as are the two dogs, on a brown, red, gravelly surface. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.